You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Oh, we lost Bruce. I hope we can hear me. Okay, so while Bruce is fixing his mic, because we're having technical problems, want to welcome you to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. We have another great show for you. And like I said, as soon as Bruce comes back and joins us, he's got to unmute himself and get his technology working. We seem to have a problem from week to week. So today we're gonna hit on
here I am.
Oh, there he is. Thank you.
There he is.
Would you like to say?
No, man, you're stealing my thunder. Another great show. We got some stuff. We're gonna talk about some new stuff.
New stuff.
Susan Fountain is hot off the press. We definitely want to do that. And then we got some traditional stuff that everybody needs to know. So
yes,
it's ladies' choice. We're going to go with the new stuff first. What do we decide?
New stuff. We'll do the new stuff.
New stuff.
So literally this was published on Friday. Under the First Step Back law, there are a number of reporting requirements. And as you might remember, it was week before last, we had even mentioned we have not yet seen the 2024 validation reports. For either pattern risk assessment or the Spark 13. That has not come out. Those would have been published in June last year. Okay. Haven't seen them. And now it's March of 2026 and we haven't seen them. So just published from the Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, is the statistics report. And this is that report that they put out, and it covers information like pattern risk assessment in terms of actual numbers, some program accomplishments and completions, and a whole bunch of other data, including some misconduct information. So I have read it in full because, you know, I'm a bit of a geek. And I also crunched some numbers because I find the way some of the information is reported is kind of interesting and doesn't actually highlight some important things. You know, Bruce, you and I have kind of harped on a little bit, both in our book and in some articles that we've published about the shortfalls of of the First Step Act, and not to get on my soapbox about a law that was meant to incentivize program participation for those individuals of highest risk and highest needs, but I will, because that's what the law is supposed to be doing, and that's what it's not doing, is those highest risk, highest needs individuals aren't really being incentivized to participate in programming, and we see that when we see these numbers. So I wanted to share some things. I'm going to take off my glasses so I can read them. So kind of an interesting thing, the good thing, the prison population has been trending down overall. It was at almost 156,000 year end of 2023. By 2024, it was down to just over 154,000. And as of today, it's just over 153,000. So the population has been trending down.
Good.
Also interesting is the numbers in terms of high school diplomas. And I found this interesting because I am a big advocate of education. The number of individuals who have completed their GED certification while in prison in 2024 was 4,210. And when the Bureau published this information, there was some backlash about, well, you know, when you consider how many individuals are in custody, that's really not a large number. But when you kind of dig into the population, more than 70% of individuals coming into Bureau custody already have a high school diploma. Right. So it's that 29% left that don't. And this number, and this is one of the things that I don't like about the reporting, is it only is reporting completion. It's not reporting participation. So these are folks that actually took and passed the exam during 2024. And that amounts to almost 10% of that population that comes into custody without a GED. Now, for every, you know, what is that number? I don't know. They didn't report it of how many individuals, you know, are taking classes. Anecdotally, I know as a case manager, as a case management coordinator, there were a lot more people participating in class than who were taking tests. I had a number of times individuals on my caseload that would, you know, might have to need the exam 2 or 3 times before they were able actually to pass it. My experience was this algebra and the writing section. I don't know if they still do the writing section, but algebra usually tripped up a lot of folks because algebra is just infinitely important. But anyway, right. Side. So to have over 4,000 individuals be able to actually take the exam, take classes, take enough, increase their skill sets enough that they were ready to take the exam, because the Bureau pretests every individual before they get ready to take the GED exam. And you might pretest 2 or 3 times before you take your actual first attempt. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a really good number. I'm always excited to see people completing their high school diploma. Also interesting, and this was huge, the number of individuals enrolled in medicated assistant drug treatment increased 112% from just under 6,000, 5,898 last in 2023 to 12,479. So more than doubled. Very, very impressive.
Wow.
There was another more than 32,000 individuals, about 21% of the population, completed either RDAP or non-res during 2024. Nice. So like 1 out of 5 people was completing it. Again,
nice.
Not the participation numbers. I'm sorry, that did include participation numbers. That was everybody. Again, a pretty significant number. We're going to dig into that number a little bit more later. Found it interesting, the number of discipline. You know, we hear a lot of people concerned about the safety of the institution and their loved ones. And we hear about incident reports and you know, they're concerned, especially in our more secure facilities, incidences of assault and things like that. But what the stats found was of the 103,000 prohibited acts committed in 2024. So just over 103 individual incident reports, from low level stuff, 400 level, you're not keeping your cell clean, all the way to that 100 level incident report that are generally violent. Those were committed by only 57,000 individuals in custody, meaning all of the incident reports in custody in 2024 were committed by just 37% of the population. That tells me a lot of people are going to prison, are doing their time, and doing their time successfully.
Following the rules, yeah.
Following the rules, doing what they need to do to just get through their time. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had more than one conversation with an individual that felt like their loved one was being targeted and was being written up excessively. And when we've had to kind of break it to them that a lot of people, even people in penitentiaries, I spent 11 years in a penitentiary. We had plenty of folks who did their entire time with no misconduct.
Right.
You know, so staying out of trouble in prison is more than reasonable. And I think it's just something that, you know, we caution all of our pretrialers. You know, you're going in there. You may see drugs. You may see cell phones. Stay away from them.
Yeah, I gotta jump in there and say, look, you know, man, and we're learning our lesson now. We've taken on clients and we didn't ask, hey, I think we have, but like, hey, has your loved one committed an infraction, you know, within the last year or two? And in this one case, the guy did a 200 series shot. We didn't know about it.
Well, we've had, yeah. And it was interesting because it looked like he was already written up and hadn't been sanctioned yet and retained us, somehow thinking we could make an incident report magically go away. And when they have you dead to rights, yeah. And they did. And then we've had to have that really tough conversation with a client who was doing well. We were helping them. We were making progress. We were getting the things that he needed. And then they went and got a cell phone shot and completely undercut everything we were doing. Yeah. Lost good conduct time, lost other privileges, impacted, maybe got DS time. So that impacted their FSA. And you know, people can kind of stomp their, you know, their foot all they want, but we warn people regularly. And I know I've gotten chastised on our Facebook group because I put out there as a kind of PSA, just don't do it. Right. You have someone who gets themselves a cell phone shot in an institution that they're in a district where the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't have a whole lot on their plate.
Right.
One of those rural institutions that are more than willing to prosecute a cell phone case to get a three-month consecutive term. That little 3-month consecutive term wipes out all of your FSA eligibility. Yeah. And again, I get chastised for beating people up about it. But as I like to say, we don't sell rainbows and unicorns, do we?
Yeah, those are the facts. So, yes, clear conduct is great. And it's good to know that the majority of the offenders, inmates, are doing good. They're following the rules. I love hearing that.
More than 60% of them. I mean, it's a good number. It's a good, solid number. This isn't, you know, a plurality. The majority of individuals are doing their time and doing their time successfully. Interesting note with regard to pattern risk assessment. 45% of the population, 20% of individuals are classified at high risk. Another 19% are classified as medium risk. And this was at year end of 2024. 45% of the population, regardless of eligibility, will not be able to apply their credit. That's a significant number.
What was the percent? Close to half? What was it?
45%.
45%.
Are not eligible to apply credit, even if they're earning it. And you and I have talked about this. And the number can vary from year to year, but we're talking in the neighborhood of 60% of the population. When you add in individuals who are ineligible, 60% of the population is not able to earn. Actually, I think it's closer to 62%, 63%. Wow. I haven't done the math recently, but that's a significant, significant number. And as this report shows, when you start breaking this down, what group of inmates is impacted negatively the most in terms of the percentages and high and medium risk level? Want to venture a guess? African-Americans.
Yeah.
To a very significant amount. They are high risk and they are medium risk. And that is a function of a variety of things. It's how the pattern risk assessment tool is set up. But as we've talked about with the pattern risk assessment, criminal history points and age are the two most heavily weighted items on the risk assessment instrument.
Did they do anything? I wish they would do an institution. I mean, I hear you about race, but in my mind, and I could be dead wrong here, I'd like to see them to partition out institution. Like, how many of those people are in mediums and penitentiaries?
They did. I have it right here. I'm going to go through all of the numbers and have people glaze over in a fit of boredom. Okay. But we'll talk more about that as we get a little bit through. But no, the overall issue is, and this is interesting because when I was still working, I had the opportunity to present a lecture in front of federal public defenders. That was an interesting crowd because I was the bureau and they were federal public defenders. So like people wouldn't even sit with me. I'd like put my little placard on the table with my name and Federal Bureau of Prisons and nobody.
You're like a leper.
I was a leper. Yes. So I remember when I got up there and I started my presentation and I said, like, for a minute, I want you to suspend your disbelief and believe that the Bureau is implementing this the way the law says. Okay. I said, the problem is the law itself. And I went through several examples in my presentation. But one of the things, because I did attend multiple workshops and I tried to focus on those workshops that had some kind of bearing on what I was doing in the Bureau and my interests. And in terms of criminal history points, which are static for the Bureau, right? Whatever your criminal history points are, when you walk in the door, it don't matter if you have a 6-month sentence or a 60-year sentence, they don't change. And because of that, if you were an individual who was just hell on wheels the first 35, 40 years of your life, and now you are sitting in federal custody, there are not enough programs and good things for you to do to offset. Right. If you've got a criminal history, you know, points of 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, you know, and the federal public defenders were talking about the negative impact of this and the fundamental fairness of it. And to be honest, I never really thought about it. I was like, criminal history points. I don't think I realized, because I was approaching it from the Bureau side, that in fact, criminal history points age for an individual. So if you did something 20 years ago, it doesn't, right, like criminal history is points are time bound. So old stuff is not held. If it's old enough, it's not held against you. And this is an area that, you know, they had a great deal of interest in kind of pressing for the Bureau to look at. And as of this point in time, they haven't. But, you know, it gave me a different perspective listening to what they talk about. So criminal history points, and if all you can do is offset, right, you can stay out of trouble and then you program. And the only other thing that can offset your points is you get older and history of violence and history of escape gets older, because those, like custody classification, those do age. And as they get older, they have less impact. So when you're talking about individuals who are programming, who are staying out of trouble, and their points are coming down, they're just not coming down fast enough, right, and far enough.
Right.
Is that right? Is that fair when they're trying to do the right thing? So I have a little bit of a pet peeve there. Actually, I have a whole lot of a pet peeve. I'm going to jump a few pages here. Of note, the completion rate, or I should say the participation rate, individuals coming into the Bureau with a high school diploma already has been increasing, has been improving. So we're seeing more education happen in the community. And by extension, that means the individuals needing to complete is coming down. But we are also seeing some modest, there was a little drop off in 2024, but some it's mostly stable than individuals. It's always between 28, or at least the last 5 years has been between 28 and 30% of the population. But one thing I did notice, and it was interesting, is I mentioned the number of individuals over 30,000 who have completed either non-res or RDAP. It was 31, almost a little over 32,000. But what I noticed was the decrease in participants from 23 to 24, and it was slight. But what was significant is the challenge program. That's one of the programs that they specifically report on. And it had been increasing in participation until this year, and it had a significant drop in participation from 23 to 24. And I think it's interesting because that's one of, you know, other than time credits, the only other program that gives individuals any incentive in terms of completion is the RDAP program. And one of the things that you and I had talked about is the expansion of program completion incentives for other significant residential programs. And the challenge program kind of high on our list. Right. It's another 9-month program. It requires individuals to commit to being clear conduct, individuals to commit to participating in programming and other self-development activities. And it is programming that is specifically for high security individuals, arguably those individuals who, at least at the security level and arguably probably paralleling in the, at the pattern risk assessment level, at highest risk and highest needs. So why wouldn't we want them to participate in a program that was developed to sort of parallel what the RDAP program does in terms of being cognitive behavior-based programming, but for individuals who don't necessarily have a substance abuse problem, but may have problems with impulsivity and managing their anger and other kind of thinking problems that get themselves in trouble. And it had a huge drop. It went from over 1,400, pushing 1,500 participants in 2023 to just over 1,100 in 2024. So a pretty significant drop in the participation level. And I suspect you've got individuals who are wanting to try to get to RDAP, they're trying to get into other things because they're focused on those time credits and kind of have left. And that's a very valuable program.
Or if you're an inmate that has a longer sentence and you're not eligible for RDAP.
A little louder, Bruce.
Oh, or if you're not eligible for RDAP, you don't have the drug history, you can't get in there.
Right.
But if you have a longer sentence, you'll take the other program.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Regardless.
So, and I, of course, I was a case management coordinator at a penitentiary where we had a challenge program. And we saw significant, it was anecdotal. I mean, it's what we were paying attention to, right? But the challenge program unit rarely had significant incidents. Incident reports obviously were lower, but graduates, because the housing unit included both folks, you know, waiting to get into the program and folks who had stayed on as mentors, long-term graduation, we were seeing those individuals were less likely to get themselves caught up in problems even after they went back to a general population unit, because their attitude about how they were going to carry themselves and conduct themselves had changed, which is what you want to see. Why wouldn't we want to incentivize that kind of self-improvement?
Yeah, it facilitates the orderly operation of the institution, which saves millions of dollars collectively.
Oh, 100%. Bruce, if you want to adjust your sound just a little bit more, you're kind of soft. I can hear you, but
kind of soft, huh?
Kind of soft.
Okay. We'll see what's going on.
But yeah, so it wasn't just good for institution operation, because a number of these individuals had a long time to serve.
Okay.
But they were really, it was that demonstrated change. And that's what FSA was all about, right? That's what FSA we wanted to see. Individuals identifying those needs, linking them with programming that would help them improve on where they were in life. And if you're seeing penitentiary inmates staying out of trouble more after having completed the program, that just translates to better behavior moving forward and a lowering of risk of recidivism. So to me, it seems like a no-brainer that an expansion there is warranted. And it's a shame that 2024 saw such a significant drop in participation in the program. Wanted to kind of touch on some of the numbers with the incident reports. And I'm going to take my glasses off again so I can see what I'm looking at. One of the tables in this report, and by the way, when we post this to the YouTube channel, we'll throw a link in the comments so people can read through in detail the report itself. But the highest percentage of incident reports across the levels, right, was coming out of medium security facilities, not necessarily the penitentiaries. Now, you know, obviously a penitentiary is going to have more security in place. You know, they have more cameras, more staff, you know, more control in the environment. So, you know, the whole, if you understand the custody classification is about looking at that individual and their risk to get in trouble and putting them in a facility that has the security to match that need, right? So high security individuals go into a high security facility because those facilities are going to have more controls. Medium security and go on down. Medium security actually had the highest number of incident reports across the board. And when you kind of broke down as a function of their population, they were also, you know, just within the population. For example, greatest severity offenses, 100 level incident reports, you know, drugs, cell phones, violence, okay? Of the number overall, 32% of incident reports occurring at medium securities facilities were 100 level offenses.
Ooh.
As compared to penitentiaries, 24% of the incident reports occurring at penitentiaries were 100 level. So not only was there more, was what the volume, the actual raw number of that 100 and some that we talked about, 103, just over 47,000 of the incident reports came out of medium security facilities. So not only were medium security facilities producing the highest number of incident reports,
there's
just in
violence.
Raw data, right?
But also violence. Yeah.
Not necessarily violence. They did not break down the violence. Those 100 level
series?
100 series, but that could be drugs. That could be cell phones. That, you know what I mean? Like 100 level incident reports are not just violent. There are 200 level incident reports that are technically violent. Fighting, threatening, minor assaults are 200 level, right? So I would suspect the bulk of those incident reports are probably drug shots, possibly. But they didn't break that. They don't give us that level of detail. Now, that would be like the geeky part of me would go in and want to do a breakdown of the types of incident reports.
For sure.
because that's what I do. Another day, we'll have to have a conversation about my dissertation. I actually did a dissertation on the classification and looked at a cohort of medium security individuals and looking at how fast were individuals that moved quickly, meaning within a year or two, to a high security facility. What was unique about them? But that's another conversation. But yeah, so at the 100 level, 32% of the incident reports for medium security compared to 24. Now, I will tell you, the 200 level incident reports, the penitentiaries had the higher number. 34% of individuals getting incident reports in the penitentiary were 200 level incident reports.
How many drug charges are in the 200 series?
None. At the 200 level, I would venture the bulk of that 34% is in threatening, fights, and minor assaults. So that's probably where they are. Interestingly enough, though, campers. So there were only 2,588 incident reports occurring at minimum security facilities. 27% of them were 100 level offenses. Want to guess what they were? Cell phones. Yeah. So the couple other I wanted to dig into, and I will tell you, you can go into this in detail. It actually breaks down by prison in terms of incident reports. So if you're wondering what's going on at your loved one's prison, you can go into table 6 and it breaks it down by security level. And then within the security level, institution by institution. So I can randomly pick an institution, tell you how many incident reports they had in 2024. And then the breakdown of 100, 200, 300, 400. So that's something, again, families
teaser.
Might be interested.
Why don't you give us a pick one? Who was? Oh crap!
Yes, you're. I can. I can't hear you. I mean, I can barely hear you. So randomly pick one.
Yeah.
So how about I pick? I don't want to pick on somebody. We'll pick on Siegelville. How about that?
Okay.
Siegelville's located in the Metroplex area there on the north-southeast side of Dallas, southeast corner of Dallas area. For those of you not familiar with Texas, they had 613 incident reports. And of that number, they had about a third of that, actually a little over a third, were 100 level, 236. I'm going with cell phones. That's a low with a satellite facility. 84 was high, and then it came down from there. They had one person got a 400 level incident report. Take a facility like...
How about who had the most 100 series in a medium?
100 series in a medium. Hold on. Let me do a quick scan here. Looks like... feel like I'm under pressure. Let's see.
You're not under pressure.
How about FCI Bennettsville?
Wow.
Had 563 100 level incident reports.
Bennettsville, South Carolina.
Yes. So, So anyway, you can go through these. You can go through them. And like I said, that is, let's see, table 6, and then, yeah, table 6 covers all of the institutions. So that's really good. And like I said, I know we see it posting all the time on the Facebook page. Can anyone tell me about this FCI or this, you know, medium, or, you know, how is it? Incident reports are a really good indicator, you know, of an institution.
Did it have lockdowns? Most lockdown?
No. It covered this particular section of the report. Mm-hmm. It did not cover lockdowns. That would be interesting as well. The data that was being collected is specifically based on what is in the FSA statute. So there, it's a very kind of structured, That is what they broke down by institution. They have another one in terms of assaults on staff, but it wasn't broke down by institution. Quickly under pressure. Yeah, there was it did have a number of assaults by offenders on Bureau of Prison staff, but that they did not have a breakdown of that. Okay. Earlier we talked about the pattern risk assessment, and the breakdown in terms of risk levels and how they broke down at the different risk levels. And they do not, in this particular table, they do not further break down like by the institution security level, like at high security, this is the risk breakdown. When and if the pattern report ever comes out, that was information that they provided. What I found interesting is unlike the DOJ's pattern report that they put out each year up until last year, they did not release the data in such a way that you could make an assessment about race and ethnicity. It was by security level, risk level, and eligibility, FSA eligibility, if they were eligible or not eligible, but they did not provide a level where you could really dig into it. This report does, and I'm on table 10 for folks making notes. This goes through the total number of individuals that were assessed at the end of 2024. So keeping in mind that while the population was, what did they say, about 154,000, you've got pre-trialers, you got people in halfway house, you got folks that just walked in the door and haven't had an initial classification. Those were not the people we were looking at, right? So there was just over 141,000 individuals who at the end of 2024 had a pattern risk assessment. They then did a breakdown of, they looked at sex, male versus female, race, white, black, Asian, Native American, Hawaiian, and other Pacific Islanders, American Indian, Alaskan Natives, and then ethnicity by Hispanic, non-Hispanic. Now, having been someone who had to run demographics for my institution on more than one occasion, and there is a little footnote that tells you this, is race is not separated by ethnicity.
Right.
So anyone who is white, non-Hispanic, or white, Hispanic are counted as white. Same thing, black, Hispanic, black, non-Hispanic. So when you look at the numbers, and this is pretty telling, of African Americans, so this is looking at race, not ethnicity, 59% of the African Americans account for roughly Caucasians, about 80,000, African Americans, about 55,000. Roughly 59% of African Americans are medium or high risk at the end of 2024. Now, for individuals with Caucasian, white, right? 35% are high. So 35% of the 79,000. 80,000, just under 80,000, are high or medium risk. Now, what is telling about that 35% number is the number of individuals who are actually white Hispanic. Most of the Hispanic population, and I just know this because I ran stats when I was in the Bureau, most Hispanics have a classification of race, white, ethnicity, Hispanic. So that number, that 80,000, has a chunk of individuals who are ethnicity is Hispanic. When we look at the number of Hispanics, just under 40,000, 39,717, 33% of them are high or medium risk. Those are individuals who are not earning. So do they tell us? So what that tells us is the number of white non-Hispanics, Caucasian folks, you and me, who are high and medium risk is even lower. There is a disparity that's happening, and it's not because of the pattern risk assessment. It's because the law isn't written to incentivize individuals who are a higher risk. It's awarding credit to individuals with minimum and low risk and those who benefit the most, who maximize and get every point they can get, are individuals who walk in the door already minimum or low risk. Jump in, Bruce, you're looking to say something.
But doesn't it say the First Step Act and the time off is for people that are of low and low risk? I mean, it is.
So what it says is everybody gets to earn this credit who's not statutorily excluded. But in order to apply the credit, in order to use the credit, right, you have to come down to that minimum or low risk level. But if you are in a situation, and we've had some people in this situation, that they're doing all of the right things. They've got clear conduct. They're doing the programming. They're doing RDAP. Right. They're doing all of that stuff. But because the first part of their life, their criminal history points was so dang high before they ever walked in the door.
Right.
They just didn't have enough time.
I wonder if they could do an addendum that individuals that were maybe in mediums and penitentiaries that had 2 or 3 years of clear conduct and had X hours of meaningful activities.
I would love to see the law amended that recognized that effort. Yeah. I'm thinking about one particular case. A young man comes into the Bureau, didn't have a long sentence, right? Comes into the Bureau and he's high, right? High violence, high general on his recidivism score. He had been a handful, right? He does RDAP. He does all kinds of other programming. He works his way. He goes from high to high medium to medium. Before he left the Bureau, he was medium low. But guess what? Medium low doesn't count. So here's an individual who has done significant programming to better himself, to be a better human being when he releases from prison to take care of his family.
He gets 4 months halfway house for RDAP.
Yeah, pretty much. He got more of that. And because he completed RDAP and literally transferred to halfway house like
the next day,
3 days later, 4 days later, it was literally one of those things, you know, finish on Thursday, leave on Monday. He didn't even know or realize that he could submit a cop out to his unit team to run up to the warden to say, hey, warden, do you want to make an exception and award him his points? But the way the law is written, once he transferred, because the law doesn't say the warden or designee, it says the warden. So even though this fellow went out to halfway house, and he actually got more than 4 months, he went out there for months, he wasn't able to get the time credits he had earned because there was no mechanism once he transferred. Because the law doesn't, you know, say the administrator or the warden or designee.
The RRM isn't the warden.
And the RRM's reentry division doesn't have a warden. So
regional
again,
director, I guess, yeah.
No. But that's the law says the warden. Yeah. That's warden, the only person who can grant that exception. So that's another flaw in the law that isn't incentivizing the people that it's supposedly designed to incentivize. Now, I'm not going to go through the rest of the report. The rest of the report covers things like a programming that's been offered, the programs that are offered, and what those programs, what need areas are addressed by certain programs. But one of the things that I could not download it, and again, for our families that ask, how is this institution? Table 12 can be downloaded. It's not part of the report. It's very long. It goes through every institution, every program, every productive activity or EBBR by need level, and shows participations and completions. So again, when you're asking the question, how is FCI El Reno, this report gives you information about incident reports, but then you also have information about the actual programming that is going on. Are they incentivized? Are they having high secure, high risk individuals, medium risk individuals actually getting to take programming, or is it low risk and minimum risk people are taking the programming, a lot of whom would have done programming anyway? And like I said, we will put the link on the website so that folks can access it directly, or on the YouTube channel.
All right, 4 minutes, 4 minutes.
4 minutes. We are not going to get to talk about detainers and pending charges and jail
week,
credit
though.
Today. I've put some notes together on that, talking about, again, jail credit is one of those things that really confuses people, and when they get it and why they don't get it. And that comes into things like concurrent and consecutive sentencing. But it also impacts, and we started to talk last week, right at the tail end, about the importance of getting resolution and that documentation regarding resolution of pending charges. But if those pending charges are wrapped up in, related to, peripheral to that federal offense and that pretrial time, and where is the credit being, who's getting the credit and who's not getting credit, that impacts the jail credit. So I thought we would talk about, again, kind of get a little bit more into the pending charges issues, but and detainers and how those are scored and how those impact. But then we're going to talk about jail credit. So we will have to save that for another day.
Next time.
So while we are wrapping it up, I will put in a plug because you're still very soft. It's a little hard to hear you. So reminding everybody that we do have the Unlocking Federal Time Credit, second edition, is available on Amazon. That is the blue book. And we have the Unlocking Designation and Custody Classification. It is the green book. And those two, the designation book is really important for those of you listening who are looking at federal sentencing. Are an attorney, and you should be knowledgeable about the PSR and the impact of the PSR beyond the sentencing guidelines and criminal history points, because they're important. And then the blue book covers, and of course, we also cover the custody classification manual. So for individuals who are looking to maybe go from a low to a minimum or a medium to a low, understanding those points and how security levels change is important. But really, if you're an attorney out there, I'm going to just beg you, get this book, read it. You're doing your clients a disservice when that PSR isn't addressed, you're not paying attention to all the issues in the PSR. That's my soapbox. And then of course we have our Unlocking Federal Time Credits. We cover everything in that book. We go through it incrementally. Again, a great resource for everybody. And it is published through Amazon. So Amazon is the publisher. Therefore, your loved ones can receive it in prison. And if for some reason they're getting pushback on receiving it, let Bruce and I know, because that is absolutely permissible. So, and with that, Bruce, you got sound yet? Better sound?
We'll see. I can just yell and scream. Is that better?
Yell and scream.
Yell and scream. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Just keep talking loudly.
I'll keep talking loudly. Well, folks, another fantastic episode. Remember to see our episodes on the LA Talk Radio site. We also have our YouTube channel, First Step Act. We have our Facebook group, Early Release from Federal Prison, First Step Act. Wonderful community, great Facebook page. You can pose your questions or ask us anytime, questions on the Facebook or the YouTube or what have you. We'll try to get with you and answer your questions. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Audible, and other places where you get your podcasts. So we're so excited to have that kind of coverage. So with that, make sure you turn in next week, because we'll cover some more very interesting things you need to know here on Around the Block. So take care, everybody, and have a good week. See you next time.
Bye-bye. Take care.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.